from the newsroom of The Washington Post.
Hi, this is Vanessa Williams from The Washington Post. I'm
calling. Hey, it's Philip Rucker at The Washington Post. Do you have a minute?
Hi, this is Dan Zak.
This is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Thursday, October 29th. Today, what it's like to run an election in a pandemic, and the French president's crusade to reform Islam.
Thank you for calling the D.C. Board of Elections. We are experiencing high call volumes as we continue to operate with limited in-office staff during the pandemic.
Good afternoon, Board of Elections. This is Mr. Everett.
Hi, I'm calling because I am trying to figure out whether or not I should still wait for a mail-in ballot. I changed my registration pretty close to the deadline for changing your address to update it to where I live now. And I haven't gotten a ballot in the mail, and I wasn't sure. For a lot of people like myself, this is what voting sounds like right now. Not just breezing into your polling place on election day, but a whole process. Trying to figure out your options, asking where's my ballot, what should I be doing, and seeking out answers from an election official.
Okay, let me have your name so I can check your status of your ballot.
Yeah.
Get your name?
It's Martine Powers, M-A-R-T-I-N-E. Across the country, election officials everywhere are getting these same kinds of calls from worried voters.
I do. Give me one second.
Oh, okay? Thank you.
Yeah.
And for Chris Anderson in Florida, it's not just phone calls. It's tweets, it's Facebook messages, it's texts.
I have 128 text messages right now.
Oh my gosh. Like work-related, like election-related text messages?
Straight up.
Chris is the election supervisor in Seminole County. I talked to him a couple weeks ago, just as he was in the middle of planning for the start of early in-person voting. If you just tell us a few words about what you had for breakfast or whatever, we just want to get a sound test before we start.
I actually did not have anything for breakfast this morning. I know it's kind of...
That's not good.
It's one of those, you know, when you're waking up at 5 a.m., it's like, I'm looking forward to lunch. I can tell you that much.
Managing an election during a presidential year is always high pressure. And that's been the case even more this year, with the pandemic, with changes to the normal voting rules, with misinformation and disinformation about which ways of voting are safe or secure. And that's why we wanted to talk to Chris, to check in with him a few times before and during this election, to hear firsthand the risks and challenges that he's dealing with, especially in a place that is pretty high stakes.
So Seminole County is a swing county in one of the largest swing states. It's been described as a picture of the United States. Our voting population is 335,000 voters. We have about 118,000 registered Republicans, about 117,000 registered Democrats, and almost 100,000 registered NPA and other party, smaller party affiliations. So we're approximately a third and a third and a third. So it's kind of interesting how our voting population lays out.
Also, you're running for re-election this year, right?
That's right. So I'm also a candidate.
I feel like that's an interesting scenario that you are going to be kind of judged immediately on the quality of basically how you did your work when people get to the polls and have their experience there and then get to fill out a ballot and decide whether or not you should have your job for another couple of years.
I don't mind that. I think it's an appropriate analysis. If I've done a good job, I hope that voters will support me.
And can I ask, are you a Democrat or Republican?
I'm a Republican. Yes, ma'am. And it is a partisan office by Florida, the election code. But be that as it may, the office is not run in a partisan manner. And none of my colleagues or I conduct ourselves in a partisan fashion. We can't. None of us, we don't attend political functions, fundraising functions. We don't associate ourselves with one side or the other. We are Switzerland, essentially. And because we have to remain above reproach. You know, I had a voter who was a Democrat who thought that she wouldn't receive help from me because Seminole County was historically a red county. And I literally jumped up from my desk and went to her house and collected a form from her that she needed to get in because she was afraid she wasn't going to vote.
And so when it comes to the particular challenges of the pandemic, what were some of the small things that you had to figure out solutions to?
One of the things we noticed is, okay, every voter is going to be using stylus to sign into our iPads to check in and get their ballots issued.
And is all the voting that you do is digital voting, like through a computer system?
It is not. So in Florida, we are a mark-sense paper ballot state. So you have to make your selections on paper, but to sign in to have that paper issued to you is on, we use iPads. We have a application that we can click on our iPad that will open up and allow us to check you in. Well, you have to use a stylus to sign your name because you have to sign in. And usually it's the same one, right? You just, you know, what each voter is using the stylus that's provided. Well, you can't do that in a pandemic because we don't want to transfer germs, right? So we had to get creative. It would have cost us about $250,000 to purchase a pen and stylus to service over 300,000 people, and we just couldn't afford it. So we had to get creative. We had to come up with something called the Seminole Safety Stylus, right?
I just need to say, right now you're holding up a Q-tip.
This may be a Q-tip to you. I know it looks like a Q-tip to you, but to us, this is a fiscal creativity, as we refer to it. We quite literally went to the Dollar Tree, in every Dollar Tree in the county. We raided their Q-tips. While everybody was hoarding toilet paper, we were hoarding Q-tips.
Huh.
And we took aluminum foil tape and we wrapped the stem of it. Now, the reason why you're doing that is because we learned that the way you swipe left or right on your iPads is through the static electricity in your body.
So you need the aluminum foil on there to be able to conduct the electricity.
Bingo. Now, the next step to that is cotton isn't a conductor. So you have to get this wet because water is. So once you take this and dip it into a moist sponge, and that water touches that tape, now you have a complete conduction of static electricity and you can sign on the pad.
So how many of those did you have to like MacGyver together just to be ready for this election?
That's a great description. It's MacGyverish, right? 101,000 stylists. We rolled 101,000.
That is crazy.
And you know, that's challenging the status quo because people didn't think we could do it and we did it. It was very fiscally creative.
You know, in some ways, I feel like that story is a story of ingenuity and really creative problem solving and also just the sheer physical work of putting together 100,000 styluses. But at the same time, I feel like that speaks to, you know, the lack of support from the federal government or, I don't know, maybe even the state government. The fact that you have to, like, come up with these crazy solutions to these problems feels like maybe that shouldn't be the case. Like, maybe there should be a solution that's not just go raid your Dollar Tree for Q-tips.
Well, you know, the money that came from the Elections Assistance Commission, that money was... it was slated to come to us, but we know our timetables, right? And most people don't in any other form of government because we have deadlines that we have to meet. So we knew we couldn't wait around for that money to trickle in because we knew it would take a while just because of all the steps that it has to go through, which is understandable. That's what brought on the creativity as well, is to say, okay, we can't wait. We got to go. We got to figure out how to get this done in our budget.
That even if there was support there, that it was just coming too late past the point where you needed to be making decisions.
Exactly. And that's not anyone's fault. It's because they just don't know our timetable. Giving us $400,000 the day before an election does us absolutely no good, or even a week before.
So when you look over the course of the next couple of weeks, what are you most worried about? And like, what keeps you up at night? Like, what is the worst case scenario that you're like, we need to do everything possible to prevent this thing from happening?
Well, you know, it was staffing, right, with election workers. But luckily, we are staffed. We are good to go. Now, it's just making sure that the equipment arrives on time, that polls open at 7 a.m. as they're supposed to, making sure that we have access to the building. That's one of the things that, you know, It's the external stuff that we can't control.
Just like getting in the building where they're supposed to be setting up in the morning?
Exactly. Because we don't own those buildings.
Yeah, if it's a school or a senior center or whatever, you're waiting for someone to open the door for you.
Exactly. And if that person doesn't wake up at, 5 a.m. and meet us out there, we're calling your phone, blowing you up like, hey, we need you to get here and open up the door, because if not, we're setting up elections equipment in the parking lot.
Yeah. And it seems like if any of those things go wrong, that's the scenario that you see on the news where you start to see this line that's going around the block and down the street. And it looks like, people aren't actually being given the right to vote because they have to wait for 4 hours.
Wait for hours to get in. And, so it's just things like that. But the supervisor's prayer is pretty simple. We don't care who wins. Just don't let it be close.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time.
I could tell you all this stuff all day long.
Well, that's one thing we were curious about is, as you're saying that, these are the things that on your mind as you start early voting next mm-hmm. week. We were wondering if it would be possible to maybe check back in with you.
Let's do it. I think that's great. Let's stay in contact. Over a third of our voting population, if they vote by mail, the precincts and the early voting sites could be ghost towns.
We actually did check in with Chris later, after the first day of in-person voting in Seminole County.
Hello.
Hi, it's Martine calling from the Post.
Hi, Martine. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I am doing all right. Day one is down.
It turns out that the first day of early voting in Florida actually broke records.
In-person voting was crazy.
It was definitely not a ghost town.
Yeah. I mean, we had lines wrapped around the building, both here at our office and in another voting location. The dedication of voting this year.
What do you mean by that?
So when I got to our office, because every supervisor of elections office in the state of Florida has to serve as a voting site. So we're one of the smaller sites. Obviously, we cannot do as many as a normal early voting site. The line was wrapped around, it was behind the building.
Yeah.
And, I'm telling people like, hey, even if it's a 20-minute drive down the road, you're going to get in to the Altamont site and be out in 5 minutes. The people that were here at our office, their thing was, I'm not voting anywhere else but at the supervisor of elections office.
Oh, I see.
I'm trusted.
Because they're worried about whether their ballot is going to
get counted. I will wait. I literally had tons of people tell me today as I walked up and down the line, I'll wait. Huh. I'm voting right here. I'm not going anywhere else.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think that there is this sort of, I guess, paranoia about...
Yeah, the national narrative has really... There's just been so much stuff going on in the past couple of... Well, just since I've been in office, I can say it. More so than most years, because although I wasn't the supervisor of elections, I voted in every election, and I paid close attention to politics, I like to think. I've never seen as much attention around ordinary things. Like poll watchers or vote by mail. This stuff has been around for years, but no one cared about it. It was just, if you voted by mail, you voted by mail.
I checked in with Chris one last time on Tuesday. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
One of the things that he's been dealing with in recent days is unintentional misinformation and the fact that voters are so paranoid that their votes aren't going to be counted.
So they call us up and they say, hey, well, I received this postcard from you saying that I haven't voted and I voted already. What's going on? What are you doing with my vote? Are you trying to suppress my vote? And, and then they turn the card over and they see that it came from a political party and they're like, oh, And then we go ahead and give them the information to let them know that we received your ballot. It's been tabulated and you're good to go. So it's just stuff like that. You know, a lot of these third parties, they get involved and sometimes they can cause more confusion more than they actually help the situation.
Have there been any other problems or challenges with actual polling places in terms of making sure everything's running smoothly? You know, obviously there's the Q-tip fixes that you came up with beforehand, but is there anything else that, like, now as we're getting into these final days of early voting that you've had to kind of work through as you see this process working in person?
Well, the challenges for the polling places, you know, so like we prepare for them. So like the power went out in Castleberry.
What do you do when that happens?
So everything, all voting equipment runs on battery backup. So even though the power's off, voting continues.
So you just have people walking through this like dark cavern space with these like little iPads?
No, we actually have floor lights. They're stand-up pole lights that light up the room. You plug them into the battery backups. We send out extra battery backups to all polling sites because this is Florida. So, you know, early voting occurs during the most active part of the hurricane season. So supervisor of elections here in Florida have already had to be kind of prepared for those scenarios at all times of what to do when, you know, a disaster occurs.
Chris Anderson is the election supervisor in Seminole County, Florida.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
And now, one more thing. On Thursday, three people were killed in a knife attack at a church in the French city of Nice. President Emmanuel Macron called it an Islamist terror attack. This attack happened at a critical time. Less than 2 weeks ago, a middle school teacher named Samuel Paty was beheaded in the suburbs of Paris. It's believed that he was killed because he showed cartoons to students of the Prophet Muhammad, cartoons that many people believe are offensive. All of this has contributed to a growing tension in France between liberal values and secularism.
The two attacks together have shocked an already traumatized nation that has known its fair share of Islamist terror attacks since 2012.
James McCauley is the Paris correspondent for The Post.
Samuel Paty fut tué. Parce que les islamistes veulent notre futur.
At a memorial service on Wednesday, Macron railed against radical Islam, saying that Samuel Paty was killed because Islamists want our future. That's one of several things he said recently that have prompted backlash from Muslims around the world.
In general, one of Macron's objectives, even before the attack, and indeed, which he delineated clearly a couple of weeks before, is this project of reforming the practice of Islam in France. But I do find that the attack and the emotion it elicited has meant that he'll have to harden his position. And I think he has already, especially in the face of a far right that's very Islamophobic and obsessed with sort of eradicating Islam from French life in general. France is home to what is likely Europe's largest Muslim community. It's the second largest religious community in France. It's a huge part of life here in this country, which is a remarkably diverse post-colonial society.
There is a long history of war and colonialism that's created tensions between France and the Islamic world. And that got worse with a wave of terrorism attacks that started in 2012 and got international attention with the 2015 attack on the office of Charlie Hebdo.
So it creates this real tension between the French Republic, which is, you know, liberal, secular, tolerant, welcoming of immigrants from all over the world, and its Muslim minority, which is, you know, obviously a huge and very diverse group that institutionally has nothing to do with these attacks, that, you know, that points out that they are committed by extremists and don't necessarily have anything to do with the group as a whole, but that, you know, that's a message that in a society increasingly on edge and that has a very, very powerful far right, notably in the form of Marine Le Pen, that, you know, gets lost. And that I think a lot of people have begun to question their fellow Muslim citizens on where their loyalties lie. You know, in France, that statement I just made would probably be criticized, and they would say that, no, we don't target Islam, we just target Islamists, or we don't target Muslims, we just target Islamism. But it's complicated.
L'islam est une religion qui vit une crise aujourd'hui, partout dans le monde. Nous ne le voyons pas que dans notre pays. C'est une crise profonde qui est liée à des tensions entre...
So, you know, Macron has said that he has doubled down on defending the caricatures, that they're essential for French sort of secular values, and mainstream Muslim groups have, of course, condemned the unspeakable violence of the attack, but it doesn't change the fact that these drawings remain deeply offensive for many of them. And it's this weird ecosystem in which now, you know, being French and declaring your loyalty to the state means, on some level, embracing these drawings. And, you know, that essentially means that some citizens perhaps feel alienated. And so I'm not sure what the aftermath of that will be, but it is a concern and it is a question.
James McCauley is the Paris correspondent for The Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Our colleagues at the Washington Post podcast, Can He Do That?, have spent the better part of 4 years reporting on the Trump presidency. They have a new series out this week about the ways that the Trump administration's policies and rhetoric have contributed to a more sharply divided country. We'll put a link in our show notes and at postreports.com. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from the Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.